everybody, and welcome to episode 46 of the Alexis Out podcast. Now, just before we began recording, me and Talal just had one of those conversations which, if you're a left winger, the hoops that you have to go through and you have to monitor and police each other for thought crime, because I saw that he was swigging out of a kind of anonymous looking fizzy water bottle, and I thought, is he using SodaStream? Because, of course, we boycott SodaStream because I think they had factories in illegal settlements in the West Bank. Other firms, by the way, that you should be boycotting, obviously McDonald's, Pret A Manger, Starbucks, and JCB, if you're for your construction equipment. If you were buying a backhoe, don't buy a JCB one or a Volvo one. Or don't Caterpillar as well, or their clothing, or their construction equipment, because they're involved in illegal Israeli house demolitions. But Talal said that he actually, he has a SodaStream machine, which he bought before, I think, they were in the West.
I don't want to cleanse myself of any guilt.
You bought it. You didn't know.
I did know. I'm a fucker.
You knew. Bastard.
It was fucking years ago. But look,
I'm not talking to you.
A crate of soda water every fucking week and go through it because I love fizzy water so much.
Yeah.
And I was just throwing so many plastic bottles in the.
That doesn't absolve you, comrade, I think.
Well.
But anyway, you found a way around it now.
I've taken more money from SodaStream than I've ever given them.
Let's not go into that.
Okay. No, I found the company that does the gas. You don't have to buy SodaStream gas. There's an English company called CO2U.
Right.
And they do gas bottles that fit into the machine, but it's nothing to do with SodaStream.
It's okay.
With them. And the bottle I drink out of is not a SodaStream bottle.
Right. Well, so if any of you have SodaStream machines that you've been not using, there's an alternative source of gas. And I'm glad you came. I'm glad you came clean, comrade, about your crimes. And
we've all slipped up, you know. People, it's you know, there's an app for it. It's called the Boycott app.
Oh, yeah.
And you scan the barcode.
Yeah.
And it tells you if it's boycott friendly or not, which makes shopping a lot easier.
Yeah, that's very useful.
But you can go around your house scanning things and just get really disappointed with all the shit in your house, because like, it is hard to avoid if you're not completely clued up. And I think it's only on Android at the moment. So yeah, we're plugging other companies at the moment. CO2U and the Boycap. I bought a really nice leather coat from a vintage shop. Well, actually, my girlfriend bought it for me because we were trying clothes on in a secondhand clothes shop.
Yeah.
And she liked the look of the jacket on me. And so she bought it for me. And a couple of days ago, I was just like looking for something in my jacket pocket, and I looked inside and I saw the label that said "Made in Israel."
No,
and I was gutted.
I don't know if it's secondhand, whether that's still you're not directly.
There's no guilt. It's secondhand.
You're not directly contributing to genocide.
Just having that label in my house made me furious. I ripped it out.
I know they made clothes as well as spyware and killer drones. I didn't know they actually made clothes in Israel. Anywho, well, I was a bit worried because this episode of the podcast is not about Gaza, and I feel a bit guilty that we're abandoning Gaza. That obviously hasn't gone away in any shape or form, and our show is still suffused with anger and rage at the continuing genocide. Nevertheless, if you'd like to tell us who's on this podcast and what they're talking about. And she's lovely.
Yeah, Ellen E. Jones, we were lucky enough to have on the show. She reached out to us because she happened to be a fan, has been listening to the show since the very conception of it, the Alexis Sale podcast. And she's an esteemed film critic. She has a show on Radio 4. She writes in The Guardian. And she's got a new book out, which she sent to me and Alexi, is called Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World. And it's a series of essays looking at film through the lens of representation, diversity, and how inherently racist a lot of films we know and love are. But it's not kind of...
No, it's very well
written. It's not a hateful book. It's written,
no, no, not at all.
Written from a love of film. And it's yeah. really, really clever and yeah. insightful.
Yeah. All right. And shall
so we had her on.
Well, let's get to it.
To be honest, I have got lots of questions that I want to ask you about your film and TV career,
excellent.
If that's
well,
all
that's
right.
No, that'd be...
Should I tell you why I invited myself on the podcast in the first place?
Yes,
please. Rather outrageously.
Which is a treat, by the way, as a podcast producer, to have someone of esteem reach out to you and say, I want to do the show. I'm like, you've saved me some work, so yeah, by all means.
I was very excited when you got back to me, yeah. So I listen to the podcast all the time, and I particularly enjoy it when you sort of talk about what you've been watching recently, and you were talking about The Equalizer, incredible films with Denzel Washington. Do you think The Equalizer is a communist, by the way? That's maybe an aside for later, but
a communist. No, I think the reverse, really, because I think that, see, I can always come up with a kind of Marxist I think The Equalizer is a kind of lie, really, because it says to us that you know, in a capitalist society, there's always somebody who will come along and equalize, you know, will right wrongs, really. And that leads to a kind of complacency, doesn't it? Where it says that you don't need to seize the means of production and the telegraph office.
Yeah.
Yeah, how old my references are. But there is somebody out there who will fix things for you, injustices, and of course there isn't, is there?
Yeah, really? No, that there's a lot of parallels with that and what I'm saying about the way race is handled in cinema generally, in terms of when they make a film about race, it's always the kind of soothing imperative to have peace before justice. You know, it's often the kind of reconciliation fantasy, like that at the end of the day, that, you know, Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen from The Green Door will be friends, or driving Miss Daisy and, you know, Morgan Freeman will be on an equal pairing, and, you know, so that's the fantasy,
That their personal reconciliation sort of somehow counterbalances the systemic class and race.
And watching the film are also cleansed of your sins.
Nevertheless, there are many interesting lessons or learnings to be derived from the Equalizer franchise, I think. I mean, first of all, I think it's interesting that it originated in a British ITV show, I think, with Edward Woodward.
Is that true? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. It was on in like the 70s.
Yeah.
It's probably shot on very early videotape. I've done no research. We try and make a virtue out of doing no research whatsoever, or, you know, having very patchy knowledge of things.
So you've not seen it. We did have an email asking if you'd seen the Edward Woodward one.
Well, I must have seen it at the time, really.
Was there like choreographed combat scenes in that?
I doubt it. I mean, my memory is that it was in black and white, but that's possibly not true. I remember it as being probably shot in a studio. In Thames TV in Teddington or something. It was mostly interiors. Maybe if they went out on location, which was very rare, it would be shot in 16mm film. So, you know, bizarrely, you would be all flat and then you'd go outside and it'd be all this kind of grainy Ken Loach hyper-realism. Because, I mean, that's my other... The other thing I was... It's been kind of going around my head in a way at the moment is that if you watch Netflix or whatever, you think that one in five people in your street is ex-special forces, aren't they? who either want to retire, you know, and are dragged back in, or, you know, I don't know, whatever, really. And also, I mean, that's another kind of thing I've been thinking about, really, because did you watch the
Queen Latifah one?
No, well, we can go back to that, but so much to talk about, just about, but the Donald Glover, Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah.
Smith.
Oh, so good.
I like that.
Alexi, I've been really enjoyed it. I've watched the first two.
I've watched it all.
I've only seen the first two as well, so no spoilers, please.
It's interesting, really, but it's not, well, I mean, I suppose it's not, I think essentially it's sort of morally muddled. I mean, there's one, I never got to the end of it. There's a Kaley Cuoco film called Role Play, in which she's a hit woman. I think married to actually Daniel, David Oyelowo. I think, yeah, she's married to him anyway. And she's a hit woman. And there seems to be no moral judgment at all. There's one point she's just casually referred to that she's taken out a trade unionist in Rio de Janeiro. But the problem is, as usual, that her organisation wants to leave. They don't want her to leave. Well, I haven't got to the end of it, really.
But in the best ones, they are sort of amoral, though, aren't they? Because that is how, if you were going to be a CIA hitman, I mean, you would have no politics whatsoever, wouldn't you? You just have to be.
No, I suppose that's true. But I wonder whether in the same sense that The Equalizer is habituating us to the idea that somebody's going to save us, that all these hitman movies habituate us to the idea that it's a perfectly legitimate career to murder people, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's nothing new in Hollywood.
No, I suppose so, but at least I suppose in The Equalizer that he only takes out the bad guys, whereas when in like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, for instance, it's unclear whether they're bad or good or what they've done.
Right? Yeah, Donald Glover is a really interesting. So, should I finish the point about Queen Latifah before I move on to? But yeah, so you were talking about how you felt that Queen Latifah in the TV series, adapted from the film, adapted from the TV series, is not a kind of not convincing as this kind of figure, I kind of just wanted to pick you up on that because there's this great show. Have you ever seen a Black Lady sketch show?
No, I know
it's a HBO thing made by Robin Thede, and like it's like all black women doing it. And one of their sketches is called "The Invisible Spy," Trinity, the Invisible Spy, and it's got this woman called Ashley Nicole Black. And the whole thing is that actually, if we're thinking about how someone really is invisible in society, you can get away with just walking into buildings and so on. That would be a kind of slightly overweight black woman,
right?
with a sort of average looking overweight black woman. So in the sketch, she's got like Kelly from Destiny's Child is in one of them, and everyone assumes that she's a spy, but she actually works in IT because she's so gorgeous and glamorous, and this other woman. Ooh. So, you know, it takes all sorts in the world of international espionage.
Yes, well, I mean, I was aware when I was talking about it that my comments on Queen Latifah could be problematic on a number of different levels, really. So I was, you know, I take your point, comrade. That
thank you, comrade.
Yeah, I need to look closer at my. I mean, because I've been, I keep using the word habituated for some reason today, but that I suppose I have been conditioned to see the central character as kind of super toned and.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's conditioning, isn't it? It's that's why film and TV is so important because it's tempting, you know, for sort of serious political minds to dismiss any discussion of this kind of thing as like culture wars nonsense. But I do think most of us get most of our information about things we don't know about other countries in the world that we never visited or about periods of history that we didn't live through. You know, we're not reading the history books, are we, most of the time? We're getting it from TV and film, even if there's some kind of skepticism there that's kind of gets seeping in through osmosis. So it's worth examining what kinds of messages TV and film is giving us.
Indeed, yeah. Well,
which is very much a topic your book covers heavily, which is, we haven't said the name of your book
yes,
yet.
So it's called Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World. And I would like to make it clear there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek Mick taking of kind of Hollywood's grandiose attitudes about like how they can save everything in that title, but that hopefully comes out a bit in the book. But like it comes from two passionately held beliefs of mine. One is that that film and TV, because it's a storytelling medium, is particularly well suited to changing our minds about things, to kind of creating empathy where it didn't previously exist, in a way that like debate programs on television or facts and statistics or arguing with people kind of that only entrenches our opinions. But storytelling kind of, I think, is that if you really want to change someone's mind and you can't give them the actual in your shoes experience, this is the closest thing to do to it. So that's part of it. And also, you know, literature does that obviously, but film and TV is a mass medium in the way that literature isn't. And then it's storytelling in the way that other mass communication mediums like social media just aren't. It really annoys me when like race debates happen on Twitter because you know, you just can't get into the depth that you would want to. And then the other key belief is that I just don't think enough people understand what race is and consequently what racism is. So meaning like it's been pretty much the scientific consensus since at least 1950 when UNESCO published this big article called The Race Question, like in the kind of after the Second World War, and it was directly addressing Nazi racism. But they basically said there is no kind of biological basis for grouping human beings according to race. Like you might have, there's no biological reality to race. It's a social construct. So it only exists, socially. That doesn't mean it's not real, but it doesn't have any basis in genetic fact. And colloquially, we still kind of think about race not in those terms. So it's the idea that we can utilize this thing that I love, going to the cinema and watching telly, to kind of disseminate a better understanding, which will help us have better conversations about race and hopefully ultimately be anti-racist and dismantle white supremacy.
That'd be a good thing.
Yeah, we can all get on board with that.
Yeah, we can. I mean, yeah.
And that is... That's kind of the premise you outline in the introduction of the book as well. And that it really holds up because, like, to me, it makes a lot of sense, because when you're having a debate with someone, the process of debating someone, even if you're using as many facts and examples as you can think of, the whole process of it, you're putting yourself in a position where you're trying to back up your argument constantly. Yeah. You're not really trying to empathize. You might be listening actively, but the whole time you're thinking, how can I use my facts to debate this? And you're not actually opening yourself up. But when you're consuming a story, which is meant to be a pastime, a leisurely activity, a relaxing thing, you're far more your heart is more open and you're absorbing something in a much more passive way.
Exactly.
And those are two very different learning experiences.
Yeah. I remember I always used to get really annoyed by like Republican senators who would be virulently anti-gay, and then like one of their daughters would come out as a lesbian and suddenly they were like pro-gay marriage or something. It's like, just what human beings are like, isn't it?
Yeah.
You need to have the experience. And if you can't give someone the experience in a real way, we have to have film and TV and art for that.
So can you give us some examples of things that successfully do that?
Well, I mean, the history of film and TV is such that most of it has been the other way around. So disseminating racism and white supremacy. Yeah. So, I mean, the first film I really talk about in depth in the book is, I think if I asked you to name the most racist film of all time, what would you say?
Well, I've read, at least to start your book, so it's a D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation.
That's right.
Which is
both an incredibly important film in cinema history. Like it basically is the difference between people like going to the Nickelodeon and watching something in one of those little visors and cinema being a real storytelling art form, and also incredibly racist. And those two things can't be divided, because the reason it's so successful at storytelling is because it's kind of picking up on these, you know, the ambient racism in America at that time.
And just to for our listeners, just that the heroes of this film are the Ku Klux Klan, basically.
Yeah, And it actually, to give another example of how cinema has a real, it's not just, it's offensive, you know, to my sensibilities, or that it's in bad taste, that it's full of blackface as well, I should mention. But like the real world impact of it was such that the Ku Klux Klan had basically become a dormant organization until Birth of a Nation came out. And then this guy's name I've forgotten, but basically a kind of preacher, saw the film and was so inspired by it that he basically revived the Ku Klux Klan. And things like cross burning, which we identify with Ku Klux Klan, come from the film. That was an idea that the film gave to the Ku Klux Klan. And so they had this kind of big cross burning ceremony on Stone Mountain, Georgia, and the Ku Klux Klan was revived, which incidentally is also the birthplace of Donald Glover. And he grew up, Stone Mountain, Georgia. He grew up watching these kind of weird, being the only black family in the area, watching these weird kind of lost cause, save the Confederacy type of shows, live shows, which were sort of a tourist attraction at the time. And then apparently he said there would be a point where they'd say, like, up the Confederacy, and everyone would turn around and throw beer cans at his family. So, which is kind of, is a very interesting origin story for someone who would go on to make Atlanta and all this incredible, like, really interesting.
Although, as I always say, I mean, a lot of great artists are outsiders, aren't they? They come from outsider communities. So either they've been brought up in a cult, or they're a lot of service brats, for example, or, yeah, well, I've been doing about how, I mean, a lot of the comic strip gang were, the Dawn French was, father was in the RAF, that Jennifer's father was in the army, and my parents were in the Viet Cong. So you just get more of a laugh with that.
It makes you good at accents as well, moving around a lot.
Just fitting in, I suppose, very quickly fitting in with people. That is a very different origin story. I don't know a lot about Donald Glover, really. I mean, he's an intro. I mean, he's beautiful. I mean, he looks.
Yeah, he's really he's an interesting character. His parents were very strictly religious, so he wasn't allowed to watch television as a kid, and he had to listen to tape recording. He secretly would listen to tape recordings of The Simpsons in bed, just the audio.
Right.
Which I presumably makes you good at writing comedy.
Atlanta. I mean, I guess I don't know whether our listeners are familiar. I mean, Atlanta is entirely a masterpiece, really, and brings a lot of. It gets harder to be original, I think, in comedy because, you know, a lot of interesting things have been done, really. But Atlanta is, really takes the genre into somewhere very different, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of horror comedy, isn't it, as well, which is entirely appropriate to the topic of American racism.
Yeah. Sorry, the European tour, which is season three or season, I think, is amazing, really. I don't know. I mean, and it's also one of the things, I don't know if we talk about this, but I mean, I'd really like to talk to him, actually, because the British are portrayed as entirely untrustworthy, aren't they? The British characters, really. Socks, for instance, in season three.
Yeah.
It's this terrible kind of, terrible kind of hanger-on white guy, I guess, wants to be back in the way. But he's responsible for, like, a lot of the really bad things that happened, isn't he, in the series, really? And all the Brits are awful, really. And that whole storyline with the jollof rice. And I mean, I think very well observed because I guess that is about British. I mean, the whole jollof rice episode is about, I did a bit, I think, in one of my, in Sandwich Bar about, fucking hamburger bars run by some fucking relative of the Duke of Norfolk. I mean, they fucking get everywhere, don't they? Now you can't,
Oliver's jerk rice is the classic of the genre. Yeah.
At least Jamie Oliver's not quite, he's not got a stately, well, he probably has got a stately home, but I mean, he's not of the aristocracy, it's aristocrats.
Yeah,
running, and I think that's a really interesting storyline in that episode of. I suppose the other thing about Atlanta is that it, you know, a series has been a success when everybody in it becomes a star, isn't it? Like Blake Heath, Stansfield, and Sasha Beats, and
Brian Tyree Henry. Yeah,
Brian Tyree Henry. I'm going completely off. But I mean, it's just William Goldman writes about how for a movie to be successful, he's very much against the auteur theory. And he says if a movie is going to be successful, seven people really need to be on their game. You know, the director, the writer, the DOP, costume, makeup and casting, really. And that series is where everybody's on the top. You know, the casting is, I mean, I suppose because you got a good script and the good script attacks best people. I don't know. But everything's brilliant in that, isn't it? I don't know.
What's another interesting thing about him is he came up on the writing teams of 30 Rock and Community. Now, I don't know. Right. I'm a big 30 Rock fan, but both of these shows have blackface in them. And they're sort of examples of this period in comedy where it's a sort of kind of liberal complacency. It was the Obama era. You know, we'd solved racism. We were in this post-racial paradise. And therefore it was okay for white liberal comedians to do blackface because clearly they weren't racist. Clearly they were satirizing the real racists. Ironic. I imagine that being in that environment is part of what inspired him to make a show that so directly confronts racism in so many uncomfortable ways.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, he plays small, I've seen him in small roles in 30 Rock. I mean, 30 Rock is amazing.
It's a masterpiece, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
But it's also occasionally racist.
Where's the blackface in it?
The Jenna character, there's about four or five different episodes, but the main one is the Jenna character gets into an argument with Tracy Jordan about who has it harder, white women or black men.
Right.
So then that inspires her to black up as a black man. I mean, it is kind of funny.
She spends a day as a black man.
Yeah, she spends a day as a black man, and then he also spends a day as a white woman. But there's other examples. But in 2020, after George Floyd got murdered, there was this sort of big sweep of the streamers all kind of pulling every episode that they could find that had blackface in from comedies, and there was lots of blackface. Like it wasn't like something that we'd done with in D.W. Griffith's time. During that time, Tina Fey and her co-writer wrote a sort of open letter apologising for the race-changing makeup but expressing an understanding that it didn't matter that her intention had been one thing, that the impact of it is still the same, which I think is quite an important thing when you're talking about racism in comedy. It doesn't matter if you intended it to satirize racism, if it's still, if it's still contributing to that sort of drip drip dehumanizing effect of racial stereotypes, then you've still messed up, haven't you?
I guess. Well, actually, one of the really interesting shows, I think, is the last series of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, season eight, I think, is really extraordinary. I don't know if you've watched that. I mean, I think it's an interesting show.
The recently
Nine-Nine.
Departed Dearly Missed Audrey Brower.
I was really upset about
it. Me too.
I'm
a big Homicide Life on the Streets fan as well, and he's incredible in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's just one of those faces that you've seen, if you watch US TV, isn't it? But I mean, and he was brilliant in as Raymond Holt in. But the first show of the last series of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Because it's obviously right in the first few weeks of Black Lives Matter, of George Floyd and all that, and they're all. It's suddenly about how disgusting the police are, and one of the Latina characters, can't remember her name, the ferocious black, the ferocious Latina
Beatrice,
woman.
Played by Beatrice.
Yeah.
What's the character's name?
Whatever. She leaves and becomes a private investigator.
Is it Stephanie Beatrice?
That's right.
Stephanie Beatrice. Yeah, you're right.
Agent Peralta.
Mm-hmm. No, Peralta's just the other one.
Ignore me.
But no, well done. We could, I mean, the fact that we can talk, you know, at this level about Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I think, I mean, would this still be considered, I mean, is Brooklyn Nine-Nine still considered marginal, or can you do a PhD about Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Oh, so popular, really, really popular.
Is it legitimate for intellectual discourse?
Oh yeah, I mean, anything is. That's if anything that I want to come from my book is that. no. But I mean, but people do talk about Brooklyn Nine-Nine a lot in the context of copaganda. Is that a word you're familiar with? Copaganda.
Oh, indeed. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So and like yeah, sort of the police loving aspects of it, and the way, and what's interesting is actually the Andre Breuer character is an example of this. Often in American TV depictions of cops, you will see a high-ranking black officer, or you will see mm-hmm. There's a lot of black women judges and stuff like that, which is like yes. Which has the effect of distorting the actual racial injustice in the criminal justice system and racial disparities in the criminal justice system by sort of pretending that, well, you know, we're all equal now, and covering up things that the way it actually works.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it's funny to see a TV series that suddenly realizes what it is and has a kind of collective nervous breakdown. It's really interesting to watch that last season. And also because it's at the time of COVID as well, so they have to cope with everybody wearing a mask.
Yeah, it was a really weird time. I mean, it's only a few years ago, but it feels like an eternity ago. But in comedy, TV comedy generally, it was a very odd time because it was like a sudden step on the brakes of this kind of period of sort of liberal complacency, I think, to do with race and in comedy and on TV. But yeah, I mean, I would love to know. Sorry, Talon.
No, I was going to say there was a couple episodes in that last series where it was a bit on the nose, but I think they dealt with it well, and at least they tried to do something. Like, it was very radical change to make the whole framework of the last season be about how horrible cops are, and but it's it's also a gift as a showrunner to be like, you know, because on your eighth season of something, you're like, how do we get anything new? Because that's when stories start to run out, and like, where do we go? How do we make it different? And then they just got this gift and had so much to work with. But that's all. I thought it was a good way.
I believe
to end
you
it.
Were going
to
ask a question.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to ask about that, like, obviously you're the godfather of alternative comedy, and we must pay respect. But like, I would love to know about, like, you know, apart from Lenny Henry, were there any other kind of people of color in that scene? And also, like, how explicitly or like were you anti-racist? How much was that part of the kind of the goals?
I think it was very central to certainly not just the rhetoric, really. I mean, as a movement, alternative comedy was, defining itself by what it wasn't really. The British, I mean, you probably know from your research, but most people will not really know, most people listening really, unless they live through it, the older demographic will not know what a kind of cesspit of kind of racism and sexism British television was in the sort of late 70s, you know, and the black and white minstrel show only finished in 1979.
Yeah.
And I used to do this bit, you know, in my about how Lenny, because Lenny was on the, you know, was in the black, was toured with the Black and White Minstrels, and he's full of guilt about it. And I said he should tell people that he was reforming them from the inside, that when he left, they were the Black and White Panthers. Which I said to him, I was interviewing him on Radio 4, and I said, I did that guy. Anyway, so we were very explicitly that we were, you know, that there was a lot of explicitly racist, particularly stand-up comedy, really, and sitcoms, and we were very much against that, really. On the other hand, I think that we were all white, so there's that as well, really.
Did any of your early material directly address any of this or lampoon the more traditional working men's club comedians and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can't remember now what, but yeah, I would have thought so. Yeah. But no, I think that was one. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I always had tremendous sympathy for Len, really, because he was expected to carry the entire burden mm-hmm. of kind of black consciousness on his own, really.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, and he kind of, I mean, he got it from all sides that you know, if he wasn't, you know, he wasn't doing enough or, you know, that he was too mainstream.
Yeah.
And I said, well, fuck it, he's, you know, he's one, he left, you know, he grew up in a white neighborhood. He left school at 15 to do this terrible bloody circuit of, you know, he was going to Aberystwyth for a week to do fucking stand up and these terrible bills, you know. Mm. And that, to expect Lenny to carry out that kind of weight by himself really was absurd.
Yeah.
So yeah. You see that over and over again in the history of these things, like the burden on the first person, like the first black woman to release a film in the UK was this woman called Ngozi N'Wura. It's called Welcome to the Terror Dome. You ever come across it? Public Enemy. Came out in 1995, but shit, the reviews of it were absolutely, it really got slated. And as you say, from both sides, because there was this kind of this expectation that she had to be representing all facets of blackness because no one black had you know, no black women had made a film that had been released before. And that, you know, there were only three films made by black British people in the whole of that decade, the 90s. So it was a lot for three films to, you know, it's an unfair burden.
Yeah. 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 Well, exactly. I mean, and it is. I mean, it's so sort of unfair in so many different ways. Really. So, yeah, we were very explicitly anti-racist and anti-sexist, really. And you know, I think that's an achievement, really. And yeah, I mean, it started to be rolled back, I think, with that kind of laddish kind of stand-up. I get an anguished email from David Baddiel now, but I mean, you know, it started to be unpicked in a way, but yeah, it stuck for a few years really. But and Len had a production company, didn't he, like Crucial Films or something. He tried to sort of make a lot of black content, but I think the whole kind of responsibility of him kind of overwhelmed him a bit.
He's doing really incredible things now in TV, like as a producer, now, yeah. Like loads of really, like really great sort of one-off dramas and series and stuff that are like really expanding, you know, what we can expect from seeing people of colour on television, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. So we tried our best.
When you asked earlier, Ellen, what's the most racist film you can think of, funnily enough, the first thing I thought of was Blazing Saddles.
Oh, really?
From 1974, which is like, purports itself and like...
It, you call me a what?
it's trying to be an anti-racist film. But it's all the comedy relies on racial tropes and a lot of Mel Brooks' stuff. Like I just saw the other day Men in Tights and the rap scene at the beginning, I was like just cringing my skin off. Like I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like, so, and the Arabs in the torture dungeon fuck me. But like so much of his comedy relies on these racial tropes. And although Blazing Saddles is trying to flip the script and be like, what if the black guy was the sheriff and he's the only good guy in the town? It's still all full of, I don't know, like, and it's made by this, you know, white dude. I don't know how does that translate into trying to change the message? A film like that.
Well, I can just say, I mean, I haven't got round to Mel Brooks really yet, but I think he is somebody who does need a severe dismantling, really. I think there's an awful lot that's troubling about his work, I think, really.
I don't know. I know Blazing Saddles, and last time I saw it, I quite liked it, which doesn't discount all of what you're saying.
No, it's hilarious. And growing up, it was one of my favorites. I'd always go back to it, but in context of this conversation, thinking about it, it's...
A lot of these kinds of conversations consist of kind of going back to your favorites from childhood with new eyes and looking at them again, and then trying to kind of reconcile the fact that which is a fact, a piece of art can be really good art and also really racist. And the racism doesn't detract from the greatness of the art, and the greatness of the art doesn't mitigate the evil of the racism, but you have to kind of hold those two things together in your head.
I went to a premiere of a Mel Brooks film in the Odeon in Shaftesbury Avenue, and I was with Alan Yentob. And
he interviewed me once on television.
Oh, did he? He's interviewed everybody. Yeah, I mean, Alan Yentob is also
he's interviewed
somebody.
Me that.
Yeah. And Alan, I mean, you know, he wants to be friends. He is friends with everybody in the world. But he went up to Mel Brooks and said, "Oh, Mel, this is Alexis Sal, young comedian, you know, young and upcoming British comedian, you know." And Mel Brooks said, "I haven't got time for that now, Alan."
But you ended up in his film, so something must happen.
I've never been in the Mel Brooks. Yeah, I've never been in the Mel Brooks film. I've been in the Mel Brooks, a film that was Mel Brooks's production
company.
Oh,
he didn't direct it.
What was that?
This is a film called, I mean, Nothing Dies Anymore, does it? I have done, I don't know how many films I've done, really, 20, 15 or 20 movies over my career. Most of them have been awful, beyond belief, really. And I think I was, one of my regrets is that I was insufficiently serious about my acting career, really, and would just do movies for, you know, the holiday, really, or the paycheck to a degree. We'll do that in a minute, but Mel Brooks had a production, development deal with, I don't know, Paramount or Warner Brothers or something, and this was a film that, it does actually link up to Indiana Jones a little bit, that he had a production deal, and this was a film he made for God knows, called Solar Babies, or it's got had different titles, Solar Babies or Solar Warriors.
Solar Babies, directed by Alan Johnson.
Alan Johnson, who was his choreographer.
1986.
So I don't, and he cut, it was really, really a really bad director. But it's got a really interesting cast. It's about a dystopian world in the future where I think all water or energy or some shit has, everything's vanished. Anyway, there's this group of kids who find like an orb, which I think will restore power to the world. But these kids, like a group of orphans who live in the desert, but also travel about on roller skates all the time. And me and Bruce Payne,
budget Mad Max.
Yeah, it was a kind of YA cross between, like, with a lot of films on, you know, like movies then could never, because movies took so long to make, they could never catch the latest trend. So you get lots of skateboard films about a year after skateboards had become unfashionable, and this was the same with roller skates. I think that it was sort of trying to cash in on a wave of popularity with roller skates, which is gone. So anyway, so there's this gang of young people who find this orb, and amongst them was Jason Patrick, a woman called Jamie Gertz, a girl called Jamie Gertz, who later was a season regular on ER.
Richard Jordan,
Bruce Payne, me and Bruce Payne, the rain in who's in Passenger 57. With another of the early black icons, with Wesley Snipes, isn't it?
Black Passenger,
yeah. C-57, yeah. He's the bad guy in that great film. The boy out of Witness, Lucas Haas, mm-hmm. And several other people who've become stars, or you know, since like Jason Patrick. You know 7 Degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Yeah.
So my Kevin Bacon score is 2 because I was in a movie with Jason Patrick. Jason Patrick was in a movie with Kevin Bacon.
That's a very good Kevin Bacon score.
It's pretty good.
I haven't been in a film with Kevin Bacon, but I did interview him. So what's that, my separation. That doesn't count, does it? Does it? If I've actually met him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a very nice man, but he wears very tight trousers. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to become friends with him just to, because we had the kind of theme about me wanting to become friends with, like, I'd like to be really good friends with a big Hollywood star.
Oh, well, I've got good news for you, actually, in that case, because I was watching your performance in The Thief Lord. Do you remember doing that one?
Oh, my God, yeah. Written by Cornelia Funke, the German J.K. Rowling. Yes, another disastrous movie, yeah.
Well, who starred in that but the bookie's favourite to be the next Bond, Aaron Taylor Johnson?
Is he in that?
Yeah. You've got scenes with him.
Was I nice to him?
Yeah. Well, your character wasn't, but I'm sure you were.
yeah.
And also George Mackay, who's a brilliant actor, is in that as a little kid as well.
I know George Mackay. I'm friendly with George Mackay a bit.
So you've got two shots there at being in the next Bond film, if you play your cards right, I think.
You'd make a great Bond villain.
People think I have, because they occasionally mistake me for Robbie Coltrane. People say I loved you in the Bond film, and it's actually Robbie. He said the other fat guy. And Robbie's much better than me. Where was that? What
you
was
made
I talking
Solar
about?
Babies. Oh,
yeah. Solar Babies, yeah.
Or Solar Warriors, sometimes known as. So,
yeah. It was produced by Mel Brooks. I think he lost his kind of development deal after that, really, because it was such a catastrophe. In the end, because a lot of these kids were also Hollywood veterans, even though they were like 15, they started directing the movie. Really
interesting. That's so funny.
This Alan Johnson, the choreographer, is this little gay guy, and they just push him out of the way and say, no, you need, because he couldn't do like background action and stuff. so they'd say, no, you got to have the crowd. And the kids started directing the movie in the end.
I'd love to see a behind the scenes documentary. Yeah,
I don't
about
know if
that.
They're making the Solar Babies. I think do you say it's become a thing on the internet now that people are fans of it? Or
no.
Oh, right. I thought you told me it had.
Nope. I'd never said that.
Oh, okay.
It's a fever dream you had once.
Apologise.
Of course, one of my other, we're talking about young, my other, is that I invented my character, Bobby Chariot, that I invented for a young Johnny Lee Miller.
That's right.
Who I cast in a film I wrote. And
so you're responsible for Johnny Lee Miller's career then?
I helped.
That was the roundabout thing, wasn't it?
Itch. Yeah.
But you said Solar Babies connects to Indiana Jones somehow, and Ellen's curious about this, about Indiana Jones.
Well, yes, because we shot it in Almeria in southern Spain, and we stayed at the same. So I'd shot Solar Babies first, and we stayed at this. We were put up in this resort called Agua Dulce. Sweetwater, and we stayed at Playa Dulce, maybe. And we stayed in a hotel in an urbanization called Agua Dulce, or vice versa. And so we'd stayed there for Solar Babies. And then when I went back a few years later to do Indiana Jones, we were in the same place. So I sort of, I can speak Spanish a bit now, but then I pretended I could speak Spanish. Really, it's a thing I do less about. So, but because I knew the resort was there, I used to take all the British actors out every night for some reason. Because I don't know how much sense this makes, but I remember there was a German guy who owned a restaurant in the urbanization. He was also in the movie, and he rides horses and stuff. He's like an extra in the movie. And he terrorized them into going to his restaurant every night, like Denham Elliott and Julian Glover and all those people. And they were all frightened of him. Yeah. Terrible restaurant. And so
British said, that you couldn't just say no and go somewhere else.
And like Denham Elliott was fucking off his head anyway. So it was like, and they couldn't, but they were too polite exactly to this forceful German guy. So I said, no, fuck that. We're not going to, this guy. And so I used to take this band of confused kind of British actors out every night.
Did you hang out with John Rhys Davies as well? He played Santa in the movie.
He wasn't, because he wasn't in, he wasn't around then. But I mean, to do that, I mean, I don't know if I've whether the listeners heard me before. So the first, I'll do some of my. The first day when I got to the set, Harrison Ford came over to me and said, "I'm a really big fan of yours." Lord of God, this is absolutely true. He said, "I'm a really big fan of yours." And I sort of thought, what the fuck use is that to me? Really? I did that. I thought, oh, fuck, I can't, you know. Like, how's that going? I don't, you know, yeah.
Can't pay your rent with pat praise.
Yeah, I mean, we're not. It's not going to work, me and you, really. Me and you. I thought, yeah.
Didn't you want him as a Hollywood pal, though?
Eh?
Didn't you want him as a Hollywood movie star pal?
I just knew it wasn't going to work, really, I think. So we had lunch with him, and he told some very funny stories about Princess Margaret. He was very amusing at lunch. And then I went to the rap party a few months later, and he was there, and he said, "Oh, hi, Alexi, what are you doing here?" I said, "I was in the film." Oh, yeah.
Fuck's sake. What are you doing here?
Yeah, so we were at the zoo in Regent's Park, the rap party. And it just, you know, I knew it wasn't going to work between me and Harrison, really.
Yeah, that's a big sign if he doesn't even remember meeting you the first time.
Yeah. No, we knew. Well, yeah,
he knew
who I was, yeah. He'd forgotten I was in the movie. Well, I didn't have a scene with him.
What was it actually like shooting the movie? Because you played the Sultan of a made-up country, right?
Iskandarun, yeah. Well, because you must have heard us, but I was railing against, you know, I was being sympathetic to Talal about how, you know, white Europeans playing Arabs in movies. Now, wrong it wasn't. He said, "Well, you fucking did it." I'm playing an Arab, and I think I may have done it again in actually a terrible, terrible, another awful film I was in called Carry On Columbus, which I think is so bad that I've got amnesia about it. But what was I talking about?
So what was it like shooting that film?
So in those days, partly, because... I mean, I think he was shooting it on 35. I don't know whether he was shooting it on 75 millimeter. I think he was shot on 35 millimeter film. And 35 millimeter film was extremely expensive, you know. So you had one camera, and then they would only, they would say, you know, yeah, they wouldn't print if the printing process was also extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't, if the take didn't work, they wouldn't. This is technical stuff, I think, sort of interesting. They wouldn't print. They wouldn't bother having it processed, really. They would only print. The director would say, "Oh, Mark takes 1, 3, and 6 for printing. You know, I don't even bother printing the others." So, but you don't. You only have one camera, a camera. And so what I would tend to do was that when they were shooting my one scene, really, they were shooting my scene, the camera was, Spielberg was sitting, the camera fair, it was like a wide, so I thought it's a wide, you know, so I tended to
make it big,
you know, not really act that well in the wide, really, yeah, just, you know, and just kind of, you know, and then when they came in for the close-up, when they physically moved the camera closer and, you know,
get that tight.
Then I'd start acting. Probably one of the reasons for my unsuccessful career. I don't think probably it wasn't a good, you know, start giving it large when the camera was like that. So I did that scene, and then I said to Spielberg, you know, "So you're coming in for the close up now?" And he said, "No, I've got A, B, and C cameras. I've got, if you look," which I had noticed, "I've got film cameras like up there and over there." So he had at least three cameras running because he could afford to. He didn't worry about the cost of film. So he was doing my close-up at the same time as he was doing my wide. And so I wasn't, I mean, in the end, it's probably not about, I wasn't giving it any acting.
Well, the best acting is not acting, right? So
well, exactly, so it was probably a good idea in a way. But I was like, "Oh, can't we go again?" He said, "No, we're off, you know, we're doing something else now." So yeah, that was me, really. Yeah, I mean, I don't know why he cast me in a way. I mean, I was very hot at the time. I think I had my own TV series. My first stuff had started. And
was there any pushback at all about playing Arab characters? Because there was, you weren't the only. I mean, there was John Rhys Davies was playing.
John Rhys Davies, fucking Welsh. He plays.
Yeah. He does it all. He's done it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. At least I'm Jewish.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Alexi here, interrupting the Alexi podcast, which makes no sense at all. Just asking you to subscribe on Patreon at alexisalepatreon.com/Patreon. What is it, Dalal?
It's patreon.com/AlexisalePodcast.
Yeah, what he said. You do criticism with Mark Kermode as well?
We got a Radio 4 show called Screenshot.
Right.
And we do. It's not really film reviews. It's more like a magazine show. We do interviews and talk about themes, underlying themes and stuff. It's good. You should come on.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. When's it on?
7:15 on Friday evenings.
Although, of course, we're not tired to...
Yes, and as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. But,
yeah.
Go to BBC iPlayer, BBC Sounds.
But no, I'm really interested in this thing of like playing different races, or like the sort of the way, the tradition of it, and also a kind of subcategory of that, which is like racially ambiguous actors and character actors and background plays and the kinds of careers those people have had.
About Hollywood. Yeah. Cliff Curtis.
Well, just to say,
Indiana Jones, I think we shot it in 88, I think came out in 89, I think, and that was not an issue at all really then. And No one ever mentioned it. It wasn't. I don't think nobody ever mentioned it, you know, critically, or never really thought about it. I mean, I did. I mean, it's a slight exaggeration, but I always say that I was offered the role in the first Mummy film.
Yeah.
And it was the role of Slimy Arab number one. And I suddenly thought, I can't. I did have a kind of Damascene moment there where I thought, I can't do this for any number of reasons. One, it is, I don't know whether the weather had changed culturally, as it were, or whether it was just an epiphany for me. But I thought, I can't play this role. It's dishonest to play this role. And also it was weird.
Yeah,
it was a horrible role, really. And so they gave it to Omid.
Who, as we know from the podcast, he evolved that role into
a lot. Yeah, he made it a lot.
Still a kind of awful depiction in that film.
Yeah.
As
I don't know what year that is.
99. And it's weird that you had that revelation then, because that was my first job in a film doing ADR. Right. So it must have been something in the air. You're like, I'm going to have a future connection with this person. Mm.
Definitely.
And you already knew my dad at that point.
I already knew because he's dad. Yeah.
And you have a really interesting chapter in your book about this.
Do I?
Islamophobia, but you do talk about Arabs as well, and then you talk about the Riz test, which I'd never heard of before. What happened, Alexi?
I thought you were talking about my book.
He said, do I? He didn't recall that chapter he'd written on Islamophobia in the film industry in his memoir.
I'm even better than I thought. Wow, I'm talented. Sorry, Alan.
That will be in your third memoir, Alexi. You can have reflections on your... in your movie career in that sense. But you do... I was very happy to see it because... obviously, Arab representation is important to me, but I never heard of this Riz test before. Would you, Alexi, do you know what I mean by the Riz test?
No.
And do you know what the Bechdel test is?
Yes, I do.
Ellen, would you?
I passed that test. I'm 71, but I passed the Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test, famously, for those who don't know, is this test of kind of... gender, women's representation on screen, and the test is that you have to have two female characters on screen talking about something that isn't their relationships with a man.
Right.
And it's surprisingly rare still for films to pass that test. But so there's various other versions of that that have a kind of racial component. There's like the DuVernay test, which is to do with African American or black representation on screen. And the RIS test, it was devised to look at Muslim representation on screen specifically. So like the Mummy came out in 1999 and there were already, as we talked about, issues with Arab representation. The main one being that it was just like, it was just this sort of misty kind of swamp of different stereotypes with no distinction between, you know, Hollywood's attitude to non-white characters has always been kind of quite casual and just anyone can play anyone, you know, no distinction between different cultures and different places and whatever. But then 9/11 happened and it got kind of much more sort of hardened. Islamophobia was evident on screen. So the RIS test is, are there any Muslims in the TV show? If there are they depicted as terrorists or terrorist sympathisers? Are the women depicted as...
Or victims of terrorists, you said.
Or victims of terrorists. And are the women depicted as meek and subservient to their men in their life? Or there's various other iterations of it. But the terrorism thing has kind of become the sort of main axis of Muslim and Arab and South Asian representation in film and TV.
And how are we doing? How are we doing on that?
How are we doing?
How's that going? Well, how's that working out?
Do you get offered, like, because you do a bit of acting, don't you, Talal?
Yeah, for some reason. Oh, Talal, what are we talking about? Are we talking about Talal? Fuck sake. Again, go on.
I do a bit of acting, yeah.
Have you encountered these kind of stereotypical roles?
So it's mostly ADR and voiceover stuff. And the early years was always "Death to America, American pig scum, kill them," and it's all that shit, like that stuff. And then a lot of it, when we started being more sympathetic, it was more the victims of terror, which I was really glad to see. The RIS test includes victims of terror, because you can't just be an Arab who's never experienced terror. No, you're either the perpetrator or the victim. And last year I did a theatre tour of Arabian Nights, and it was written by a white guy, written and directed, and I was the only Arab on the cast. And it was all very fast and loose with kind of accents and fun.
I've just realised that's three, because I was in a Hallmark Channel production of Arabian Nights as well.
Yeah.
Three times I've misrepresented. I've played an Arab.
Yeah.
Although most of my part was played by a rubber version of me.
Yeah. Rubber Alexi. We did a whole episode on this.
Rubber Alexi. Yeah.
And definitely encounter it. And it's my big pet peeve is when Arabs are portrayed by non-Arabs, and if it's not just a tanned Westerner, they get a South Asian to play Arabs.
Yeah.
Like in Lost, like in Community.
Yeah.
It grinds my gears, man.
Did you ever watch the quite racist TV show Homeland?
I avoided it.
I watched the first series, which I thought was... I mean, she does do great going crazy, doesn't she?
And Damian Lewis, as much as I dislike the man personally, is a brilliant, brilliant actor. Yeah.
For my own self-preservation, I avoid shit like that in 24.
Let me tell you about something that's going to cheer you up a little bit then with regard to Homeland. In like the fifth series, they were shooting something that was supposed to be set in a Syrian refugee camp. Have you heard this story?
So
they hired some Arabic speaking graffiti artists to do some, they were shooting it in Berlin, obviously. They hired some Arabic graffiti artists to kind of give some authentic look to the surroundings. And they wrote loads of kind of really great, funny graffiti in Arabic, which of course the producers didn't bother to translate. So they wrote stuff like Homeland is racist in Arabic, in, which appears in the TV show. They also wrote Black Lives Matter and Homeland is a joke and it's not funny. And like to compound the sort of the insult of the show itself, the fact that they didn't even bother to translate what these guys had written, because to them, you know, Arabic script is not a real language. It's just kind of, exactly. It just says everything.
Oh, that's so good.
But it was a lovely little example of people getting their own back.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah.
And then I haven't said, of course, the Riz test is named after Riz Ahmed, who's a Pakistani-British actor. He's kind of like, in a way that you might compare to Sidney Poitier or like Rita Moreno or Anna May Wong, who's a Chinese-American star of the silent era. Like he's got a lot of weight on his back in terms of representing all facets of Muslim identity and stuff on screen, but he's doing pretty well.
And also the idea of the Riz test, and there's still to this like a conflation of Arab and Muslim, which kind of winds me up. But I completely understand where it's coming from. But there, people don't differentiate between Arab and Muslim enough, if you ask me. And a big part, and you know, you said at the beginning, Alexi, this is an episode about Gaza, but I think a huge part of why Israel's getting away with what it's doing is because of the global representation of Arabs and how the dehumanization and fucking racist attitude towards Arabs is so prevalent to this day, and people don't view them. You said a really interesting thing in the book about how the notion of an Arab civilian is a provable contradiction in terms. In regards to rules of engagement, the film.
Yeah, so this is William Friedkin film. I get in trouble for slagging off William Friedkin because he directed The Exorcist, which is my co-host on Screenshot, Mark Kermode's favourite film of all time.
That's a French Connection.
Lots of very good films. But Rules of Engagement is a film made in 2000, so just before 9/11, and it really kind of encapsulates the sort of pre-9/11 attitude to Arabs. And also, it's really interesting as an example of the military-industrial complex, entertainment industrial complex in Hollywood. So, like, you can't make a film about the war and spies and things like that in the moment in Hollywood without having input from the actual CIA and the actual Department of Defense, because you want to borrow their equipment and therefore you need their approval for the script.
Yeah, I did a bit about it in Sandwich Bar.
So it ends up being this kind of propaganda, essentially, that's just like, that's the story of really every American US like military or military adjacent thriller since the 1980s, you know, like Top Gun. They've all had direct input from the Department of Defense and the CIA and so on. But Rules of Engagement is an example of that. And it's got Tommy Lee Jones in, whose cousin, if you ever want to go down a deep rabbit hole, look up a guy called Chase Brandon. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
He's a CIA's man in Hollywood and was an active CIA agent for a long time. And he's also Tommy Lee Jones's cousin. Weirdly.
Because Tommy Lee Jones also shared a room when he was at college with George Bush or somebody, or one of the check it out.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Bill Clinton or somebody.
But anyway, the film is all about, it's a kind of military court.
Al Gore.
Al Gore. He shared a room at college with Al Gore.
It's where Samuel L. Jackson's character is on trial for essentially massacring a load of Arab men, women, and children. And he gets, to cut a long story short, he gets off at the end because it turns out they were all carrying guns. It's just that nobody could see them except him from his particular point of view.
Shit.
Including, there's an actual shot of a very small girl like whipping out a kind of a massive, you know, AK-47.
So it's
basically proving this point or the point of view of the film or of Hollywood or America at the time, that like there's no such thing as an Arab civilian, that you're safest to shoot first and ask questions later because they're
Jesus,
all
rich, yeah, you know? That's something that's going on.
And it does have like Talal saying, this kind of like, you can think, oh, it's just a movie, it's just something you switch off your brain and watch. But I firmly believe that kind of drip dehumanization of groups of people, when it comes time to like legislate against them or drop bombs on them or think about whether they need clean drinking water or any other sort of thing, it just makes it easier to go ahead and ignore all those human rights. So And we've got numerous examples of that. Like, I think the representation of Arab people and Palestinians in particular is in contemporary cinema is very comparable to the representation of Indigenous Americans in the Westerns.
Yes.
In terms of, in the sense that they're always there, and if they're, and but never differentiated as individual human beings, always just the kind of the enemy, or sometimes like a part of the natural landscape that we have to overcome in order to claim our land.
And when they are good or pure, there's it's they're the exception, or they're the ones who are like, come with me, American. I will look after you. Three Kings, as great a film as that is you've got that kind of problem.
It's a fucking great film, Three Kings.
And also there are no famous Arabs in the West.
Yeah.
Like, all the famous Arabs we have are not Arab. Riz Ahmed is not Arab. Kai Van Novak's not Arab. Omid Jalili's not Arab. Who are famous Arabs? Saddam Hussein is a famous Arab. But he's evil, you know. Him and Gaddafi are like real Arabs we can mention. But where are the real stars, the famous Arabs that people can empathize with and relate to?
What's the name of the woman it says something that I can't remember her name, but the first wife in, or the second wife in Succession, Hayam Abbas. She's Palestinian.
Is she Palestinian? Yeah, I was so happy to see her name every week. Yeah, she is Palestinian.
Can you give us an example, Ellen, of a film or films or TV shows that, you know, are good, you know, that do a good thing, make the world a better place?
Yeah. I mean, there's various ways. The most basic thing is just what we've been talking about, like in terms of really like diverse representation of different racial groups. And I think it's important to say that good representation doesn't mean the characters are morally good.
No.
Like, we need to not confuse those two things. Well, that sometimes does get confused. It means good representation means properly, fully rounded human characters in all their, you know, contradictions and variety and strangeness, and which is something that has kind of, for the most of the history of cinema, has been reserved for white people. And also good representation needs to come from behind the camera, from the creative storytelling point of view, it's not sufficient to just sprinkle a few people of color in your period drama and then tick the box and you're done. Like, this, it has to be diversity on a deep storytelling level as well, or it's not working. So that's the first thing. But what I'm kind of get really excited about is films and TV shows that are actually picking apart or drawing our attention to the sort of ambiguous, changeable, context-dependent nature of race itself. So there's a film that I really like called Passing.
I haven't seen it,
So it's directed by Rebecca Hall, and it's starring
Sir Peter Hall's daughter.
Sir Peter Hall's daughter, who is also on her mother's side, has some African American heritage as well, some Indigenous American, which is relevant to the film, which is an adaptation of Nella Larson's 1929 book about this phenomenon of passing across the color line, which can only really make sense in a segregated society or like where you have one drop. But basically, there were people in the segregated South who would look white. You or I would probably racialize them as white, but in the context of their time, they would be racialized as Negro, Negresses, or African American, because they had at least one drop, as according to the racist one drop rule, of African blood, and these people would be living in segregated, therefore poorer communities. But having this kind of access to white privilege would sometimes take advantage of it by crossing the color line and passing themselves off as white in white communities. And that's obviously like...
What's that beautiful film with Mahalia Jackson sings at the end of it? And
Imitation of Life, my favorite film.
Imitation of Life.
One of my favorite films from 1959, the Douglas Sirk version. Yeah, that's all about... There used to be loads of films made about passing. There was another one called Pinky. A lot of them would have a white woman playing the supposedly mixed race character, which is classic Hollywood. But Rebecca Hall made this film, this black and white film about that, and it stars two mixed race actresses, Ruth Negger and Tessa Thompson. And it's just the way she shoots it draws our attention to the fact that in certain contexts, skin color looks black, and certain contexts it looks white or brown, I should say, or white. And if people can be both black and white in the same, you know, frame, then maybe it's all nonsense, you know. So I find that really exciting.
Any other good films that do their job that are saving the world?
I mean, there's like I love. Have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon?
I haven't seen it yet. It keeps.
It's when 3 hours, 20 minutes long.
Yeah,
so.
My friend who went to see it in the cinema said, "When you're in your 60s or 70s, you have to go nil by mouth before you can sit through it because you can't go."
Steve McQueen documentary that's 4 hours and 20 minutes out at the moment called Occupied City, which is fantastic, and has an intermission, which is very magnanimous. Yeah, so go see that. But Killers of the Flower Moon is really, I find it really interesting because it's about whiteness, and that's another part of the conversation that I think people need to be making more. There needs to be more white filmmakers making films about what it means to be white and for white people. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I mean it, because that's when you kind of dethrone whiteness from this position of being able to speak for the commonality of humanity, to speak for everyone, to be universal, whereas everyone who's raced or racialized only gets to speak for their race, you know? So it's like, that's kind of one of the aspects of whiteness in cinema and film. So, but Killers of the Flower Moon, I think, is like a really interesting, proper revisionist Western, if you like. And it only works, though, because of things like Reservation Dogs, which is Sterling Harjo's really great TV series about life on a reservation in Oklahoma. And because Indigenous filmmakers are making their own films and telling their own stories, you can have something like Martin Scorsese doing it from a different angle, and it's not just a slap around the face. It kind of adds to the big tapestry of it all.
Have you been watching True Detective, The Night Country?
Yeah. I feel like it. How many have you seen?
I'm not quite up to date yet. I think I'm on episode 4.
Yeah, I feel she's Callie Reese, the woman playing. She's great, I think.
Yeah.
Talk about big physical presence as well.
Is she Native American?
She is, I think. Yeah. Like, I think she's Hawaiian, Indigenous Hawaiian and something else. I'll get a little TV nerd fact for you. The younger cop in that, Jodie Foster's protege.
Yeah.
He's the Hackney born son of Ronan Bennett, who's the top boy guy.
Oh, really? Ronan Bennett, who actually went to prison as well, was in the IRA.
Yeah, he went to prison wrongly accused of
IRA bombing and being in the Angry Brigade and all that.
Yeah.
Bloody hell, I didn't know that. Well, all right, I'll give you I'll anecdote you back then, because I did a movie with Jodie Foster.
Oh yeah,
years ago.
I think she's wonderful.
She is, and we did a night shoot together. There's a scene where I don't know if it's her, but somebody trips me, and I mean, movies are one of the things that maybe ever talks about is how dangerous movies are to make. I mean, I've been on several films where people have died, movie making process. And I've nearly been killed several times. And in this, I don't know whether it's Jodie Foster, somebody trips me anyway, and I went over backwards and bashed my head on the back of my head on the, but nobody did anything. I mean, I just saw, at some point I'd stunned myself anyway. But then I sat and had a long chat to Jodie Foster throughout the night. I can just remember us sitting on canvas chairs together chatting. And I think it was when she subsequently gave up movie making years and went, and she was talking about wanting to go to Harvard and be a student, which of course she did for her. That's all I can really remember, partly because I don't
know. How do you know this is not a concussed fantasy, though?
Head. I do, yes, it's possible. Well, I was definitely in the movie with Jodie Foster, so that
But this is Siesta from the year I was born, 1987.
Yes.
With an absolutely amazing cast. Gabriel Byrne, Julian Sands, Isabella Rossellini, Martin Sheen, Grace Jones, and Alexi motherfucking Sale. Ellen Barkin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I need to watch this movie.
But I sort of fantasize when I'm watching it about, I don't know, like going and doing an interview or something. Not that people, I used to do interviews sometimes for the Radio Times. I'm being sent to interview Jodie Foster and saying, "Hi, Jodie, we were last worked together in 1987. Do you remember that night we spent together? But I mean, it's never going to happen, really. It's a non-anecdote. Anecdote, isn't it?
A
really?
Boy can anyway. Dream, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you know
what,
the movie?
Do you remember what she talked about or anything?
Well, mostly I think she talked about wanting to not work in movies anymore and go and be a student, I think, which she subsequently did, I think. I've got lots of sort of non, you know.
Shall I tell you the Alexei Sale film I was watching on YouTube the other day?
Yes.
Do you remember doing a film called, I think its US title was Curacao and its UK one was Deadly Currents.
Yes.
In which you play a South African spy master.
Yes.
and it's got the bloke out of CSI as well, isn't it?
Yeah, William Paston. And I think it's the last film that George C. Scott ever made.
Yes.
He died more or less while making it, I think.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's that was a Showtime movie. It was made for television. And I got to fire an Ingram, because I'm a, well, as you know, if you listen to, you know, I'm an ammunition and firearms nut. And in that film, I am armed with an Ingram Mach-10 in .45 caliber ACP. I didn't have an armorer on the film. The producer didn't know how to cock it. And I said to him, "Now give me that." He said, "You cock it, you turn the charging handle on the top. It's the same as a Thompson." And I racked it back. And then but it was really dangerous not having an armor. You know, it was so dangerous.
Yeah, as Alec Baldwin knows.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. It was a very Alec Baldwin situation. The producer was just doing the firearms, really. I'm not ashamed of my performance in that. I'm all right in it, I think, aren't I? As the South African spy master, I'm pretty good.
Yeah, your accent's pretty good.
Yeah, I know, and I'm not that good at accent. I didn't have any instruction or anything. Again, I don't know why the fuck I was in that movie. We spent a week in Curacao. George C. Scott, he stayed away from everybody, really. I think he was very ill. At the time, because I worked with quite a few actors, because of course I worked with Lee Marvin and he died soon after. Can I tell you my Lee Marvin? Have I told my Lee Marvin story?
No.
Do you want to hear my Lee Marvin? You're a big fan of Lee Marvin.
Yes, of course.
I mean, for those younger listeners, they wouldn't. I mean, an actor, a method actor came through Lee Strasberg and, an actor of tremendous presence, really extraordinary. Been in the Marines during the war, got his ass shot off on Saipan or Iwo Jima or somewhere, was in the Big Red, 1st Marine Corps. So proper tough guy. And I just a wonderful, wonderful. Been in some amazing Capaloo, which I think is also a bit dubious now. The Killers, A Day at Black Rock. A really iconic actor, and I was really. Anyway, there's this scene in Gorky Park, which is a movie we were in together, where I get again a dangerous. I get shot in the head, and they made me wearing like an explosive charge on my head with the blood pack. That's how they did it in those days. But they forgot to put protective backing on. So it flew back into my head and nearly killed me.
My God.
So I think this is the sequence of events. So then they were going to do it again, but they put earplugs in my ears, or maybe it was before the shock. I don't know. They put earplugs in my ears because it was going to be explosive on my head, but then makeup sort of painted them so you couldn't see them. So I was sitting in makeup. Lee Marvin came, and he was a famously enigmatic guy, you know, people, nobody ever like it, you know, he'd never wouldn't give interviews or, you know, he's I was sitting in makeup with these earplugs in, and Lee Marvin came and sat next to me and talked to me for half an hour, pouring his heart out to me. And I couldn't hear a fucking word because I had the fucking earplugs in. Occasionally I'd hear, you know, what I really feel about Brando is, you know, oh, yeah.
Do you think he was drawn to you because he knew you had earplugs in?
Do you think that's possible? Yeah. I never thought of that.
He needed to get something off his chest, yeah. but he didn't want to share.
People would, you know, would stop talking when he came through. He had such presence.
Real presence,
real,
yeah.
Amazing. He lived
That's really
life,
exciting. You know? Because you meet a lot of, well, I'm like, for my job, meet a lot of actors and stuff like that. And like, so the famous thing gets a bit boring. But every now and again, you'll meet a proper movie star that has real, like, because it is just something you can't quantify.
It's like a glow, isn't it? I can remember being at a premiere with, like, Stallone, I think, and there's just a kind of vibration. Arnie, you know, there's something kind of, yeah, like you say, there's a quality that just vibrates off them, isn't there, really? Real presence, yeah.
Yeah, because when you talk, as I am doing in this book, like, complaining, I guess, about a lot of films and TV shows, like pointing out stuff that people don't really want to have pointed out, that things are racist. I think, you know, the concern is that you're going to take away the joy of movie watching and of TV watching. And that I just sort of want to say that absolutely isn't the case. Like, I think it's a way of sort of showing your love of cinema and the joy that you take in it by, like, holding it to a high standard and pointing out that there are ways it can, you know, be even better. And just talking about movies and telling is a way of affirming the value of the art. It's something worth actually thinking about, you know, spending some time.
Like you said, these are movies we love, but just like, you know, like when you grow older and you realize that your parents are like flawed human beings and you grew up your whole life admiring and worshiping your parents. And then one day you realize, oh shit, they're just human and they've said and done some fucked up shit. Yeah. Just like I've done and like everyone is going to do.
That's such a good comparison, yeah.
You hold them accountable, and it's a really well-written, really good, well-put-together book that I'm going to enjoy reading the rest of.
Thank you for giving it a look.
For sure.
Have you interviewed Matt Damon?
Never met Matt Damon, no.
Jeremy Renner, any of the Bournes?
No, I mean, I'm sure I'm sure I've interviewed someone who's been in a Bourne film, but none of the big Bourne boys.
Right. I did ADR on the second Bourne film. I played some Arab terrorists.
I know, I can't fucking watch it now. That's one of my favourite scenes in the movie. Yeah, what I can hear is you going, blah, 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 blah.
Get him!
It's in the chase through Tangiers.
Would you know it was Talal's voice, even if he hadn't told you?
I think I realised. I thought, fucking hell, that's Talal. Ruined it.
He's over there! Yeah. just say anything in Arabic. They've recently started having Arabic consultants in the studio with us, or on like a Zoom thing, like zooming in from Egypt, while we're doing ADR sessions, and they're there to make sure the Arabic is good and the accents are.
You can't shout Homeland is racist anymore.
Yeah.
No, they can't.
They can't.
I can go on do this for hours, really.
Yeah, we should do a follow-up, but it's getting to be an hour and a half, but we should do a follow-up. But then not, think,
Annie, we've got nowhere near scratching the surface of...
We haven't done...
There's Denzel Washington being introduced to a kebab as an example of Italian cuisine in Equalizer 3, I think is one of the, I don't know what the fuck that's about. So many things to talk about, really.
Denzel was the person that Will Smith went to for advice when he came off the stage having just punched Chris Rock. Slapped Chris Rock. Then I wonder what Denzel said to Will Smith in that moment.
I don't know if this is going completely up what we're talking about, but it's about stardom, I suppose. There's a Lee Strasberg's daughter, Susan Strasberg, I think, is talking. There's a documentary about Marilyn Monroe, I think. And they're walking through Los Angeles or somewhere here in Marilyn Monroe. Nobody's paying them any attention. And Marilyn Monroe says to Susan Strasberg, do you want to see her? And Susan says, what do you want to see her hair? And Marilyn Monroe just very slightly changes something about her posture or brings some light from inside. And suddenly everybody starts looking at them. Suddenly everybody's going, fucking hell, there's Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
You know, I just love that. Do you want to see her?
Yeah. You know, wow. It's the Cary Grant thing as well, isn't it? That you said that everyone wants to meet Cary Grant, including me, or something like that.
It's all fake.
Yeah.
It's all make-believe. It's a fairy tale land of wonder.
But it's also that you can switch that. You can switch that quality on, you know.
Well, that's quite healthy, isn't it, if you can? Because then you can separate the persona that everyone's talking about and has opinions about from your own private self and keep them.
I mean, unfortunately, Marilyn, I think, probably couldn't do that, really.
But, no.
I think that's what differentiates the real stars. Like, my encounters with that, I've noticed that glint in the eye or that ability to turn on that powerful presence. And it's like, oh, that's why I'm not much more successful. I can't do you just did. What you just did is super impressive, and I can't do that yet. Touch wood. Let's see.
Ellen, thank you so much. That's fantastic.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
I hope it was all right for you. I'll be having
really good.
The book, Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World by Ellen E. Jones. It's a... Alexis L podcast recommend.
Oh, get amazing.
Alexis and Terrell's book club.
Yes. Yes. That's all I've ever dreamed of. Thank you so much.
it's really good. Go out and get it. And thank you. Yeah. We'll get you back. Yes. Ellen,
yeah,
you come back.
Love that. There are still some dark corners of Alexis Sales filmography that we're yet to explore. I'm willing to go there.
When you think about it, there's a lot, really. There's a lot to be.
let's just do a special on Carry On Columbus, because there's a lot to talk about.
Do you know what?
Okay.
I know. I don't know what I was doing in that fucking film. I don't know why. I'm happy to talk about it.
Let's get Nigel Planer on for that one.
Was Nigel in there?
Yeah.
Was he sure?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Rick Mayall.
Julian Clary. Decent in it and got terrible reviews.
Nigel plays the Wazir.
Really? Are there more? We were drunk all the time on that film.
We'll get into it next time.
Oh, yeah. I would love to talk about it. It's interesting for me to talk about my extremely patchwork film career because I don't, you know, it brings it all back, really.
Those are the best. It's the best cut for me. It's the most interesting because the way everything's interconnected and you touch on lots of different sort of topics and stuff.
Yeah.
Ellen, is there anything else you want to tell the listeners? You do a weekly show.
Podcast. So I've got I'm on Screenshot, BBC Radio 4, which is on 7:15 on Fridays, and wherever you get your podcasts. And the book Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World is published by Faber and it's out now. And I'm in The Guardian quite a lot as well. All right.
Thank you, Anne. That was great.
Thank you very much. It was really lovely to meet you both.
So that was Ellen E. Jones, and we'd love to get her back on again. And she did sort of sotto voce mention that I should come on... a show with Mark Kermode as well, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. Most weeks I am on Radio 4, but there's the odd week when I'm not, so, you know, we need to fill in those gaps. I think the listeners get restive if I'm not on. I love talking about failed movies that I've been in, and there are so many. We covered Solar. It's always a bad sign when a film has got more than one title. Mm-hmm. It's always a sign that it's a turkey, really. Like Solar Babies, which is also called Solar Warriors in other markets, and that film Curacao. I think it was only a telly movie, but that had many different titles. The Circling of Sharks, I remember it was called at one point. Curacao, and I think it went out on US TV as Dangerous Currents. I mean, it's all right. It's not terrible. But I love talking about all those. I mean, I have been in so many NAF movies that, and it gives me tremendous pleasure to talk about them, really. Which is odd.
Write a song about them. An ode to all the shit films you've been in.
Do a bit, I suppose, would be the
Oh, mate, you could do a whole show just talking about the films and the experiences.
Yeah.
You know, The Bride sounds like it was an amazing experience.
The Bride, yeah. And obviously Siesta, there's a lot more. I mean, I'm not on these films usually for very long, but I get a tremendous number of anecdotes out of my brief, you know. They're rich in stories, really. I should do some. I mean, I've been thinking about doing some stand-up about, all the bad movies I've been in.
Talking of movies, could I quickly throw a shout out to a film I saw this week?
Yes.
There's a very low budget but very good film called Out of Darkness in the cinemas right now. And it's like a prehistoric horror film about early man, a small tribe of people who are trying to survive. And they get the shit scared out of them. And my very talented friend, Adam, did the music for that film.
Okay. And
he's a really talented soundtrack music person. He did Saint Maud a few years ago as well, which was a little sleeper hit. But Out of Darkness, I want to recommend it. Give my friend some props.
All right. Out of Darkness, that's Lexi's pick to watch this week.
Yeah.
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 Let's do that every week.
What have you watched this week? Have you watched anything new?
Yeah, I watched a really interesting film, actually, which was made during lockdown and didn't get the attention it deserved, I think. It was on television, and I think we watched it on iPlayer or I don't know what. Film 4, but it was called The Kid Detective with Adam Brody, who was years ago in one of those US kind of soaps. And it was terrific. It was about something. You know, I mean, again, it's just to see a film that isn't about an ex-fucking hitman living in suburbia is, a delight, really. Lexi's pick of the watch this week was The Kid Detective, Adam Brody.
Oh, great.
I'd recommend it.
You can watch it on Channel 4 on demand for free.
For free, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That looks cool. All right. Yeah, let's do that every week. Every outro, I'm going to ask you what you've watched.
All right, yeah.
And you can recommend something.
Okay, well, that's all. Yeah, that's just... I don't know about your generation, but my generation, that's all we really talk about is what we've watched.
Mm-hmm.
Since
and if
lockdown.
You're listening at home and you go and watch The Kid Detective, then you can, tweet at us or Instagram us at AlexisLPod, or better yet, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you can message or post on there. Go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Support the show, please.
Yeah, get that algorithm spinning.
Algos.
I want to get those 6 million hits that I got with the Christmas message.
Mm.
I want that feeling back.
Yes, please.
I want that validation. All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the AlexisL podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.